Hi, and welcome back to Cultural Counterpower. I am Laura Rykovich, and I am broadcasting from the Francis Kite Club here in New York City. Today, we're going to be talking emancipatory propaganda with Jonas Stahl. And propaganda is obviously a big word, and it has a lot of big feelings attached to it. And my special guest today is both an artist and the founder of the New World Summit. His name is Jonas Stahl, and he is also a dear friend of mine. And Jonas wrote a book called Propaganda Art in the 21st Century, which I find very inspiring for both its historical look at, or its look at historical uses of propaganda, the ways that propaganda is formulated, its power, its logics, and also for a very powerful provocation that for me has become a foundational aspect of how I think about the world, which is that Jonas poses this question: what if we created a propaganda that was not based on the accumulation and consolidation of power, but rather centered on a goal of mutual liberation? Could such an emancipatory propaganda reframe the way that we live and the way that we see our world today? I think this is really fruitful ground for discussion, and I hope you'll join me in the podcast to hear what we talk about. Hi, I'm Laura Rykovich, and welcome to Cultural Counterpower. We're broadcasting from the Francis Kite Club here in New York City, which is also the ancestral home of the Lenape people, where I am fortunate to live and raise a family. And I want to just express my gratitude to the Lenape people for stewarding this land since time immemorial. Today, my guest is artist and founder of the New World Summit, Jonas Stahl. And I first met Jonas over a decade ago in the early years of the summit, which the summit is a artistic and political organization that develops parliaments and assemblies for stateless, with and for stateless, blacklisted, and autonomous organizations. And he's recently created a parallel project called the Court for Intergenerational Climate Crimes, that, in his words, is a more than human tribunal that aims to prosecute climate crimes by states and corporations, not only in the past and present, but also in the future. I have participated in some of Jonas' summits and have witnessed the CICC, and they are, in my estimation, not only wonderful experiences, but powerful examples of collectively built ways of reimagining how we might live in our world, how we might express our culture, our power. And Jonas is not only the maker of these projects with his many collaborators, but he's also the author of this book, Propaganda Art in the 21st Century. And I encourage you, he's done many other amazing things, and I encourage you to visit his website. So, Propaganda Art in the 21st Century is, to me, a touchstone that I've been relying on since the book came out, Jonas. Actually, since before the book came out, because I was lucky enough to read a draft of it. And, you know, not only is the book a really powerful and important review of the history of propaganda, its relationship to various movements, both on the left and on the right, the way it's been used throughout history, but it also poses an extremely important and provocative question, which is, what if there What if we could create a propaganda that was not based in the consolidation of power, but rather in the opposite, in a commitment to mutual liberation? What would that look like? What would that mean? Would that potentially create a mode of reimagining our whole universe, of reimagining the way we relate to one another, of reimagining how we might construct a more viable, a more just political and social realm? And so I know that, you know, in your work, you have continued to consider these questions around propaganda. And I thought we could start with why you chose propaganda as a subject of study. And maybe we should start with how you define it.
Yes, well, thank you, first of all, for having me. And it's a big pleasure to be in conversation again, in an ongoing conversation. The subject of propaganda, for me, is relevant because propaganda essentially is about world-making. I understand propaganda as the aim to construct a new reality. And that is not, by definition, an oppressive reality or an emancipatory reality. That's just what propaganda is. It operates through infrastructure, through narrative, and through imagination to create a new reality. And then with infrastructure, we can think of infrastructures of circulation, from mass media to educational institutions, like the infrastructures we need to introduce a certain story, a certain imaginary. The narrative is what is that story. Is that a story that tells us something about where we come from, who we are yet to become, or in the case of many of the ultra-nationalist and alt-right narratives, who we are supposed to become again. And the aspect of imagination is, in propaganda, relates to how through infrastructure and narrative we then visualize a horizon of that reality to come, or that reality to come yet again. And for me, in every possible way, that process of the making of propaganda relates to the field of culture and to the field of art, specifically when it comes to narrative and imagination and the stories that we tell and the worlds that we imagine into being. And in a way, propaganda maybe helps us to understand how powerful art and culture really is. That in order to change the world, we will need an imagination of that world that we want to change first. And as such, imagination is never neutral and is never innocent. And maybe that's both the excitement and somehow also the danger of what we do as cultural workers, that the imaginaries we open are like seeds, like a kind of time seeds that we plant. And once we plant something in the imagination, it's possible becoming has begun. It's possible to sow, to propagate in the biological sense of the term, that time seed, that seed of the imagination later on.
I particularly love this idea of planting the seed through an artwork, you know, and I've been thinking actually a lot about where the art happens, you know, when an artwork is conceived, when it's materialized, when it has people to interact with it, when it's remembered. There are all these kind of points at which that seed might begin germinating, right? And so the idea of, you know, that seed being propaganda or being, you know, an incitement to create a new world is to me a very exciting idea. And I'm going to read from just a small snippet from your book, because I think that that this is why, from a practical perspective, even though this kind of terminology sounds very aspirational, you know, idealistic, perhaps even a bit utopian, it's actually really grounded in the way our politics are playing out in this very moment. And you know, you write, reactivating propaganda and propaganda art studies can be only one part of the answer to our present-day crises, conflicts, and deepening precarity. Yes, we need to understand who authors our world in our name. Who authors our world in our name? But we also need to gain control over the means of production through which our realities are constructed in order to make new ones. And I think that is a very concise analysis, actually, of our current political condition, particularly in relationship to the kind of fascist and right-wing turn in governments and politics around the world. And I wanted to talk kind of specifically about how this is unfolding both in the United States and Europe, as that's where we both sit, and how we see, to maybe describe how we see the right kind of executing this or displaying a really profound facility with world defining, and how we might counter that, you know, and what is that, what might that look like?
I partially wrote this book, Propaganda Art in the 21st Century, to challenge a very narrow definition of propaganda, in which propaganda is always and only attributed to authoritarian regimes and dictatorships of the past, and it would somehow no longer be applicable to our present, and somehow not have a logic that denies the emancipatory heritage that propaganda has as well, the role propaganda has played in the socialist movements, in civil rights, black liberation, feminist, ecological movements, how propaganda was theorized from the perspective of national liberation movements, etc. But that doesn't mean that this oppressive dimension of propaganda is not also very much part of this larger, of the larger history of propaganda. And as you say, I think at this moment we are witnessing a various fascisms converging, which have neo-fascisms converging, which have understood profoundly that culture and narrative is are detrimental to establishing a new hegemony, and that artists and theater makers and game designers are a critical component to that. And I call this, in a way, the shadow art world. Like, we operate in one art world, a critically engaged, socially engaged art world, which certainly has certain impacts. But I think it oftentimes is also quite naive when it comes to understanding the means of production that are necessary to produce a reality that manifests itself concretely for the many. And the shadow art world is an art world that consists of the cinematic work of Steve Bannon, the ideologue of Donald Trump. You would say former ideologue, but I'm not convinced that is really the case. I would say continuous ideologue and propagandist for Trump, who built a cinematic oeuvre of 20 years in which he tried and tested all the narratives we have come to know as Trumpism. First, in relationship to the heritage of Reagan and the paleo-conservative wing of the Republican Party, then for Tea Party figureheads like Sarah Palin, then Trump, which he himself calls an imperfect vehicle. Here we have a propaganda artist who has been trying and testing Trumpism, white economic nationalism, white Christian economic nationalism, this doctrine, even before Trumpism came onto the political stage. So we see that imagination precedes, prefigures reality. And something similar happens with the science fiction writers that are currently employed by the French Minister of French Ministry of Defense, which asks these specific science fiction writers to develop scenes, like to write scenarios of possible future conflicts for the military to anticipate on how to deal with future cyber confrontations with the Chinese People's Republic and you name it. Of course, the difficulty of that is that the moment that our infrastructures begun, military infrastructures start to anticipate threats that are not yet there, we also create the possibilities of threats to come into being. And this is a strange thing that I would call the rogue imaginary. And that is also a part of propaganda. That
so what you're saying is, in a way, the mere imagining of it might make it come into being. The mere suggestion of it by these kind of actors who are being invited to imagine something so that it can be defended against by the military or by some other state agent actually might actualize it.
And I would say generally probably something worse, because that's what a rogue imaginary is. You imagine a threat first, and then once that threat actually starts to manifest through your imagination, it might take off and become something far worse. So when the so-called war on terror began, this almost, you know, this dystopian utopian war, because in a way it strove for a world without terror, a threatless world. But the way to fight this terror was through perpetual terror that created the conditions for organizations like the Islamic State to emerge out of the black sites in Iraq, and the destabilization after the invasion and occupation of Iraq. The Islamic State, if we wouldn't have a trajectory leading to it, it's almost unimaginable. Like if the Islamic State would emerge in a pre-2001 Hollywood film, we would say it's simply obscene. It's an obscene imagination. It's a caricature. It's offensive. It's like it's unimaginable in a way. It's unimaginable to be real. And this is what I mean with rogue imagination, that a fight against a form of terror that didn't exactly exist in the way that the Bush regime at the time was claiming it did, came into being through fighting a non-existing terror. Something much worse came into being.
And so in this kind of space of the rogue imagination, you know, we seem to consistently see the forces of oppression using these methodologies extremely successfully, whether it's intentional or not, as you kind of point out, that this can actually come about in a kind of unintentional, intentional way. How do you use that same propaganda's technique towards emancipation, towards getting that mask of populism to drop?
I mean, when you study propaganda, like a figure like Bannon, for example, there's often these moments where you're tricked into thinking, why don't we have a left Bannon? Why don't we have an emancipatory Bannon? Someone just as cunning, capable of like shamelessly appropriating the infrastructures necessary to redistribute wealth and collectivize common resources. But of course, propaganda might exist in all forms of in the context of all political ideologies. But the things that you believe about the reality you want to construct do inform how you construct it. You can't manipulate yourself away into an emancipatory world. I think the history of emancipatory propaganda is always based on the idea of collective propagation, not about mass manipulation, but about collective emancipation. And that makes emancipatory propagandas always more complex. Maybe this is part of our struggle, is that the types of narratives that we have to tell about the world that we want to create can't rely on some nostalgic reconstruction of a past that, well, never existed, and also even if it existed, shouldn't be resurrected. Emancipation is always based on this paradox of becoming something that you cannot yet know in the current conditions of oppression. It's always about creating a world in which liberation means liberating yourself from something that oppresses you also in the here and now. So what we might become together through an emancipatory propaganda is always something that is partially to be known as part of that process. But it's a more difficult, it's a more complex narrative to propagate, to seed, than that of the return to a safer, to the idea of a safer past, especially in a world that is so perpetually plagued by crises as the one that we find ourselves in today.
Yeah, and I think this point is extremely important because it is the collective commitment to an emancipatory propaganda, let's say, in all of its diversity and in all of the ways in which we might approach that question of what is an emancipatory propaganda differently, that makes it potentially effective, right? Like, it is not one idea, you know, a la the Bannon type of world rewriting or remaking, but it is a multiplicity of ideas that need to be hashed out in real time and in a space of difference, right? I mean, I think that's a core piece of the challenge of what an emancipatory propaganda might look like. And so it then becomes a question of, like, how does that get cultivated in multiple realms? And perhaps, you know, in spaces of multiplicity, as you have constructed through the New World Summit and the assemblies and the parliaments that the summit has convened, but also obviously in multiple manifestations of cultural storytelling, of cultural invention. So that it's not all coming out of, like, one mind that's, you know, say, telling us what the story should be. It's the multiplicity of minds that is important to this potential future emancipatory propaganda.
Yes, and that's why it's important that we organize in the here and now, because I think organizing is essentially, and it is act of collective prefiguration of the world that we want and that we begin to seed in the present. And that's what I mean with that to create an emancipatory reality needs an emancipatory propaganda cannot mimic the tactics of oppressive and manipulative propaganda of our opponents. It means that already in the here and now, transparently and collectively, we start to create the worlds that we want to see. And you referenced the Black Panther Party as an example that I also write about in my book, and a figure like Emery Douglas, former Minister of Culture of the Black Panther Party. Emery Douglas was not an artist who by himself proposed an imaginary of a world to come. He depicted the world at present, the structural oppression and the institutionalized white supremacy in the U.S. State apparatus, but he also imagined the world of liberation to come, and he did so within the context of a party that was an organization that produced culture, that produced a new form of public culture through the journals that he oversaw, the poster production, the murals, the workshops with children and young people and young artists. Through internationalist exchanges, Emery Douglas always referenced the work of artists in national liberation movements from Cuba to Vietnam. So he also saw his struggle, his cultural work, as part of a larger historical and contemporary cultural dialogue. And it was inherently tied to wings that went from the breakfast program, the food program for children and communities that the Black Panther Party organized, and the capability to organize self-defense for communities systemically faced with police violence and murder. So his work was intrinsically tied to this organizational prefiguration, one that was able to confront real oppressions and struggles of the present without ever abandoning the creation of horizon of where that organization would possibly, where it could lead to, what kind of reality it could seed in the near future. And I think that's exactly a model that that is a model of the recent past, but that, that is very much an example of the challenge that we face as well, to link our imaginary competences and qualities as artists and cultural workers to organizing work, to the collective imaginary of constructing a reality anew.
And I think that this is so profoundly important and relevant, particularly to the climate emergency, because as we've seen for decades, the denial of all the facts and proof and all of this. And what's clear is that there's a lot of work that has been done on the more kind of emotional and experiential side of things that has made far more headway in terms of convincing the general public to understand climate emergency as such. And so I guess, you know, maybe we can talk a little bit about the Court for Intergenerational Climate Crimes as a tool for getting into that space that you're talking about of both contending with deep past, but also the future in the very real present. I mean, I think maybe talk a little bit about what that project does, and performs, because I think there's something in that that is so telling about the kind of time frames on which you're talking about here, where like the pre-enactment relates to how you function today, and yet it is also profoundly about pasts and potential futures.
Yeah, so the Court for Intergenerational Climate Crimes is what I call an organizational art project, so an artwork in the form of an alternative organizational model, in this case, a court, that I initiated together with a lawyer, Rada de Souza, lawyer, writer, activist, academic. And we created this court to prosecute climate criminals, corporations, and state implicated in climate crimes, in past, present, but also future. So what we're trying to confront through an alternative legal framework that Rada developed based on much of her case history as a lawyer, called the Intergenerational Climate Crimes Act 2021, is an alternative legal framework that that acknowledges the future as plaintiff. So at present, in our existing legal system, the future doesn't exist. You can only prosecute criminals based on crimes of the past that have to be brought in front of the court through evidence in the present. The future, unborn, human, plants, animals, they do not exist. They do not have rights. They are rightless in this context, even though we know that the climate criminals are currently committing ecocide, omnicide on this very future. That this this is the reality is the death of millions through mass suffocation, mass burning, mass drowning. We know it. We have the evidence for it, but we cannot prosecute on behalf of the future. And in the alternative legal framework that we propagate through the Court for Intergenerational Climate Crimes, through our lawyers, through our public prosecutor, through our judges and the audience who in our courts become public jury, does recognize this unborn life, the rights of the future. This is not to be confused with the way that evangelists have been propagating against the right to abortion. And the right to bodily autonomy. This has to do with the right of life to exist, of life to propagate, for the conditions of life to live. This is in essence what the intergenerational climate crimes act represents.
And I also think what's fascinating about that is that you're also granting rights, in a sense, to the extinct, right? I mean, they're witnesses in a way. Your paintings of the extinct species that no longer walk this earth as kind of co-plaintiffs, perhaps, or witnesses of some kind. I mean, that's how I interpret the kind of extinct species that are involved in this project, where you've actually painted these animals and life forms that no longer occupy, that no longer live, can live on this earth, as present in the proceedings, as witnesses, as co-plaintiffs, I don't know, as presences that that have an influence over this kind of legal process.
Yes, Radha and I decided that we wanted to build the Court for Intergenerational Climate Crimes in its manifold iterations, because we have been organizing public hearings from Amsterdam to Guangzhou, out of evidence of climate crimes. And the evidence out of which we build the courts are, as you mentioned, depictions of animals and plants that have gone extinct from colonization onwards to the present. And that shows the archive of extinctions of our world shows that mass extinctions began not in the industrial period, but began in the colonial period. And as such, we argue that climate crisis is a colonial crisis, is a product of turning the world into property, into turning living beings into property. And with the mass extinction of animals and plants, we also witness the mass extinction, the forced extinction of cultures, of languages, of the very memory of the world that you acknowledged, the moment that you acknowledged the land that's from where you are speaking at this moment in our conversation. So for us, that was very important, that the evidence of historical climate crimes would be present, constitutive of the court, and as such that and in that way would also make present our non-human ancestors, our non-human comrades, as part of a struggle in the present for the possibility to live in the future. We try to do that without speaking of rights. Rada has, my collaborator, has developed a long and profound critique of the very concept of rights, from the idea that rights always assume a proprietary relationship to the world. So she believes that it is possible to constitute a new law, a new legal imaginary, without speaking of rights as such. But as you notice in this conversation, even for me, it's sometimes difficult to let go. Yeah. I become so accustomed to thinking of rights as something that has an emancipatory dimension of it to it as well.
Right. And I think that this question of rights and who's granted rights and who isn't, or what, you know, because I think that one of the things that you are pointing to in this project is that non-human entities also have agency in this way of storytelling, right? That is really important. And I think to tie it back to kind of how this is a reimagination, not only this conversation around rights, right, which is about rethinking how we imagine what is possible from an emancipation or liberatory perspective, right? But also, you know, that kind of takes as a starting point not where we currently are, but where we will be if we continue on this path. And I think that there's a kind of that you need to get people to buy into that in some way. Like, you need to, in order for somebody to kind of understand what the court is doing, right, you need to create a certain set of circumstances that people say, okay, well, it is possible that humans won't survive, and so therefore this court makes sense. So how do you, with a, you know, and this is to me like a kind of a piece of the propaganda situation, because it's like even within this one artwork, you have to kind of create the conditions where somebody could even understand the terms that you're talking about, right? So like somebody walking into the court has to appreciate, you know, that this is a court that's going to determine how the future unfolds. And so how do you bring people into that? You know, what is your approach to bringing people into that conversation to kind of like knock down that first domino that allows the kind of rest of the story to unfold? What's the point of entry?
I mean, I think for a project like the Court for Intergenerational Climate Crimes has many points of entry. Like the court, as we discuss it now, the actual public, the 6 to 8 hour public hearings that we organize, in which people who are normally members of the public become members of a public jury, who are required to study the Intergenerational Climate Crimes Act, who listen through detailed testimony and evidence of our plaintiffs, who then have to test and link that to the legal framework that is presented to them in order to come to a judgment. The apparatus of the court that produces detailed judgments and documentation of all of these proceedings. Of course, this is a extremely intensive process that is not that engages climate activists and progressive scientists and policymakers, and our juries are people that have a stake in this struggle. Of course, the image of the court is something that circulates already much wider. Like it can be as simple as a sentence. Did you know there's this court? It prosecutes climate criminals for the future. As a kind of parallel to maybe Kim Stanley Robinson's Ministry of the Future. Something that in only a few sentences can evoke the image of something else, and in which it can be shown that it even exists. Like if you, when you visit our courts, you visit the court. We have prosecuted Airbus, ING Group, Unilever, the Dutch state. You enter into a space in which these proceedings take place. They are material. They are material in reality. They are as real as we are collectively willing to perform them into being. And this is, of course, the truth of all of our institutions. Right.
And I think what you're doing in a kind of maybe in a 10,000 feet way is taking a structure, a cultural infrastructure, meaning the court system, a system of justice or a theoretical system of justice, and transforming it, taking it and transforming the idea of what that is, the ideal, into something that could actually perform something that is more just than the current courts at our disposal.
It is depending on whether a collective of people would decide it to be so, it would be the court that we all need, but that we don't have. And when our existing courts are turning into obscene theaters that are essentially defending the rights of the people who are burning our futures more than the people who are being burned, that is the moment to transform our theaters into the courts that we actually need. We can reappropriate that process and turn it into something else. In the end, constitutions and legal documents are just scripts, and the spaces in which they are enacted are theaters, are spaces that are built through architecture, through visual imagination, from judges to politicians. They are all actors performing a script. That doesn't mean that this is not a theater, a performance that doesn't have a profound impact on reality. It shows exactly that imagination directly shapes and constitutes reality. But it also shows that if we no longer agree with the way that we are governed, if we no longer agree with the inherent criminality of our law, that we can write the law differently, that we can enact it differently. And what we are trying to do, what Rada and me are trying to do as part of a much larger climate justice movement, is to contribute an imagination to prove, in a way, to give evidence that if we want that court for the future, the court for intergenerational climate crimes to become real, it can be done. Like, we're proving that it can be done. If we collectively decide for it to become real, it is as real as we want it to be.
Exactly. And I think that that is the thing that this court makes visible, perhaps in some ways, is the inherent injustice of the current court, right? I mean, I think that there is a very clear difference between the two, even if they are, even if they both are using these theatrical modes of operating. And I think that's also very useful, that you're taking something that's super familiar, but that people perhaps have a different expectation of what might come out of it, to invert that into a different kind of outcome. Sitting here today, especially thinking, you know, I was reading this morning an article about the kind of the anti-fascist protests that have been unfolding all over Germany these last weeks, and really thinking about, you know, this idea of how populist rhetoric has become this kind of mask that is worn by oligarchs and politicians who wish to appeal to a broad base while in fact pursuing their own very selfish goals of, essentially, I mean, that can be summarized by the consolidation of wealth and power, which has been the kind of traditional use of propaganda. and thinking about how mass protest movements also enact a kind of emancipatory propaganda, because they release that mask. They show that it is not necessarily true and real. And I think one of the things that really impacted me about, you know, how these protests are unfolding in Germany today, and also how the massive and historic Black Lives Matter protests unfolded here in the United States, was just the sheer quantity and the sheer number of people who were denying that other reality. And I think that this goes straight to your point about emancipatory propagandas, and that, you know, it is these collective and bottom-up efforts that reveal themselves to be another reality that is possible. There's a connection that I want to make between the fact that the idea of the nation state is an out-of-date construct, that it is actually a complete invention and a fallacy, that every time we see people crossing geographies, whether it's due to climate or economic emergency or war, some combination of all of those factors, that we understand that these are all fictions, and how do we reconstruct realities to reflect that these are fictions rather than something that need to be guarded?
Yes. Well, let's say the nation states that are the inheritors of empire indeed inflict this perpetual violence upon the world, and this causes the very conditions for forced mass migration that you're describing. I mean, I think one angle could be to redefine the narrative of what we want our states to be, maybe as cooperatives, for example. Like maybe I would rather speak of a Dutch cooperative than I want to speak of the Dutch state or the Dutch nation, because I think once you start, I mean, the existence of a state apparatus you can concretely infrastructurally argue for to a certain extent, because its supposed sovereignty is of course a fiction. The nation already becomes much more problematic. I would much rather want to look at the possible cooperative coalitions and relationships that allow for to hold common means of production of our community, of the production of energy resources, of food resources, of the distribution of the infrastructure for transportation and mobility and accessibility from a cooperative point of view. I find it more logic. I find it more more rational. I find it more just. It comes closer to my idea of what a community really is, as a collective of workers, as a collective of earth workers, which might include which goes beyond humans alone, but all of our fellow earth workers with which we try to maintain a livable biosphere. So part of the response is also, can we produce the narratives and imaginations of what we used to call our states to become something else? Maybe something that we can already begin to enact in the very present, because most of the time the state is nowhere to be seen in any case. Most of the time, and for most people, we rely on each other and on the relationships of trust that exist within the place-based community in which we operate. But most of the time, there is not really a state apart from as a kind of hovering, as a governing concept rather than as a practical reality. So even from that practical experience of reality and those relations of trust that make up the intimacy of our actual lived lives, there might already be the seed in our very lived reality of how that reality could be organized differently.
Well, and I like how you've just tied this back to the beginning of our conversation when we started talking about seeding ideas and germinating those in different contexts. And maybe that this is a good place for us to finish our conversation, even though it feels like we've only just begun, because I love what you have to say about emancipatory propaganda, Jonas. Thank you so much. And I also think that there is so much left to be said around how that is activated in a political space, social space, economic space that is profoundly unequal and inequitable, and how we begin to reimagine those spaces as we want to live in them. And there seem to be a few routes to do that, multiple routes to do that, but it begins with the imagination. It begins with us thinking afresh about how we want to be in the world, because if we can't imagine it at the end of the day, how can we even hope to realize it? So thank you very much, and I look forward to talking to you again soon.